Okay. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone, and welcome. First and foremost, I want to thank Ronit for your hospitality. We're excited to be here. Ronit was away for a long weekend, just got back whatever hour late last night, so we appreciate your pulling everything together and your generosity in hosting, and we're looking forward to really making a trend of this, whether it be here, not your home, but other locations that look forward to just opportunities for us to spread the wealth, get more people engaged, and really excited about that. I also want to just mention that this is an outgrowth of our fabulous Tuesday morning Jewish history class. So anyone who has available any time, you're always welcome to join us. 10:30 in the school, we're doing medieval Jewish history. And actually, we're going to be starting with a piece that's related to some things that we've been studying. It's just absolutely fascinating material, and everyone is welcome to join us for that as well. There's some flyers with one or two past events, but also upcoming events. So if you haven't yet registered for Rabbi Sacks, you're welcome to do so. In addition to the events that are listed on these, I wanted to mention two others. Our Women's Chagiga, sorry, Jerry, is taking place, scheduled for Sunday, March 27th. If anyone's interested in participating, it's open to all women in the community. Please let me know. We'll get you all the information that you need. We're also very excited that we're hosting Tanakh scholar Rabbi David Foreman. He'll be coming for pre-Pesach Shir. That's going to be Sunday morning, April 3rd. April 3rd, Sunday morning, starting at 10 a.m. in the Beit Midrash. So Aaron will work on for that. There was one email that went out, but there'll be more information coming out as well. But we are excited to host him as well. He has a great book on Esther, if anyone's interested, so it's timely. So if you haven't yet seen his book on Esther, highly recommended. And he also has this Aleph Beta Academy. They have these narrated cartoon-based shiurim. Fantastic stuff. Aleph Beta Academy. You can go online, and they have relationships with schools that have started using his materials. And it's just a lot of fun. They have these cute, intelligent cartoon characters sort of coupled with these sophisticated, interesting, engaging shiurim. So it's just a lot of fun to watch and to listen to. He's very bright. He's out of the box. He's very interesting background. He went to Neri Yisrael. So he has a yeshiva background, and he's nonetheless sort of moved not only to come sort of out of the traditional realms to, you know, wider interest in Tanakh and some fascinating areas of studies. Really interesting person. So I welcome that Sunday morning, April 3rd at 10 a.m. No RSVP required. So let's see everyone there as well. This morning, what I'd like to do is to really begin with a story. It's just one story, but there are lots of stories, and we'll see that so many of the stories seem to tell much the same story, and that's exactly what we're going to be seeing this morning. I want to start with the year 1236. 1236, Jewish community in Narbonne. Narbonne is in the southern area of France, known as then as Provence. We know that the Jewish community of France was divided into two sections, the northern area, which is the larger Jewish community. That's where Rashi was from. His whole family, his grandchildren, Rabbi Nutam, the Tosafists, some of the great scholars of Jewish history. But then you also had a Jewish community further south. One of the differences between the two communities is that the northern community suffered tremendous anti-Semitism from an earlier stage. So you had the beginnings of the Crusades coming through Germany, but France as well, or all the way back in 1096, and just a lot of anti-Semitism coming through. But in southern France, things were relatively benign, relatively secure. People were relatively okay. Jews and their Christian neighbors certainly were not always on best friend terms. Certainly things have changed for the better dramatically nowadays. Things weren't great back then, but we also didn't necessarily have some of the anti-Semitic flare-ups that you have in many different communities at that time in other areas, including northern France. So here you have a relatively secure Jewish community. Then all of a sudden we have an incident. It's an incident that's shrouded in some mystery, but it begins a trend that ultimately leads to, or is part of a larger trend, as we'll see, of these later Jewish communities that begin to celebrate a Purim of their own. And so you have all these communities following this model, or together with this model, celebrating some sort of anti-Semitic incident in which they saw themselves as endangered in one way or another, some miraculous event that causes them to somehow be redeemed. They celebrate it as a local Purim, and you have this time and time and time again. One of the prominent examples, and since our Jewish history class has been looking at the history of Ashkenaz in particular, I wanted to start with this example, this community of Narbonne in 1236. What happens? Well, truth is, we don't really know exactly what happened. As many events in medieval Jewish history, it's mired in some obscurity. There are lots of different accounts. Some of them are bare bones. Some of them are really developed very fully. Hard to know exactly what. But here's what we think we know. We're pretty confident that there was an altercation. There was a fight between a Christian fisherman and a Jew. The Jew, of course, was not local. He was not from southern France, because no southern Frenchman Jew for that community would involve themselves in such a violent incident. But it was actually, they blamed it on anyway, a Jew from the north. It was from northern France. It was one of them. It was one of the, you know, he had lots of fights with prior incidents with the Christian neighbors, things like that. And here he is, and he's getting into an argument with this Christian fisherman. We don't know exactly what happens. It comes to blows. There is a devastating, even mortal wound that the Jew seems, at least according to many reports, to inflict upon the Christian fisherman. We don't know exactly when that happens, but what we do know, according to some accounts, is by the time we come to the 20th of Adar of that year, in 1236 in Narbonne, France, we have this Christian individual ultimately, we think, passing away from the wounds, dying from the wounds. There's an uprising, a mass uprising, something that a community in southern France has not necessarily seen before, certainly not this Jewish community. All of a sudden you have mobs who are threatening the Jewish community. We don't know what's going to happen. Ultimately, though, the local governor intercedes on behalf of the Jewish community, settles everyone down, and kinds of things begin to, the simmering stops, and the Jewish community is ultimately spared from a pogrom, which unfortunately we had become quite familiar with in other parts of the Jewish community and continue to be familiar with throughout much of medieval Jewish history and well beyond, as we will see. And here's what's interesting. The date on which the Jewish community was saved from this attempted pogrom was this day, the 20th of Adar. It's interesting, though, is that the Jewish community chose to celebrate not on that day, but rather 15. On the next. No, they didn't go back, although you might have thought that would have been one pass away. But they actually, I'm going to talk about the relevance of the date of Purim, but they celebrate the next day. So they're saved on the 20th of Adar. According to many traditions, they actually celebrate not on the 20th, but rather on the 21st. And according to many traditions, hard to know for sure, but we think that for decades, if not centuries, the Jewish community of Narbonne celebrated the Purim of Narbonne, except it was not on the 14th of Adar, and it had nothing to do with a guy named Haman or another one named Ahasuerus and the heroine of Esther, the hero Mordechai. None of them is mentioned. All you have is this incident that happened between the Christian fisherman and the Jewish individual from northern France, and somehow it all works itself out, and they celebrate for many years to come. Also unclear is when the incident actually originally took place. Right? We know that there was an altercation. We know that there was a fight. The rest is kind of lost to history. 20th of Adar, we think he passes away, the Christian individual. When did this altercation take place? We don't know, but we think it might have been a couple days before. Maybe on Purim itself, interestingly enough. Any thoughts as to why the community would celebrate this Purim holiday, not on the day that they were saved, but on the next day, the day after?
Same as
Purim, right? What happens in Purim? What's the day? What do we celebrate outside of walled cities? When do we celebrate Purim? What day? 14th of Adar. When were the Jews actually successful on the battlefield?
13th.
According to the Megillah, we'll see a little bit later on. The 13th of Adar. What about the walled cities? Why do we celebrate a day later? Because the battle extended for an additional day in places like Shushan, other walled, walled cities. So what do? So we celebrate nowadays in Yerushalayim, rather walled cities on, right? Or we really celebrate the 15th, right? A day later. When did the battle conclude? In Shushan, in the walled city?
On the 15th.
Right? Well, it concluded on the 14th, but then the celebration again is the day later. So in other communities, they were victorious on the 13th, celebrated on the 14th, the Megillah says. In Shushan, they were victorious on the 14th, they celebrated on the 15th. So mimicking the model of Purim, the community of Narbonne seems to choose to celebrate a day later. Now, mind you, it's just the month of Adar. It's a week later. Maybe the incident was tied to Purim. Hard to know for sure. But they continue to call this the Purim of Narbonne. If you Google, just go online and Google Purim of Narbonne, it's actually a term that you'll find out there. Again, the details are, seem to be lost history. We really don't know too much about it. But this is part of a phenomenon, a large, wider phenomenon, where we have communities that are under attack, and once they're saved, they celebrate it as a modern-day Purim. They call it a Purim. In this case, it doesn't happen this way, but in other instances, they declare their enemy to be none other than Haman himself, Haman HaRasha, or the equivalent, whoever it is, just fill in the blank, right? It almost doesn't matter. It's just a template. Haman tried to kill us, and then maybe we had the Esther or the Mordecai who came to our safety, right? Who came to our salvation with the help of God, and we celebrate it, maybe even a day later. We have this trend. Such a fascinating thing. And another question I'd like to raise from the outset, just to kind of put out there food for thought, Purim sounds like a good fit, but there might have been other holidays, right? I mean, what happened on Hanukkah, for example? Did we not have an Antiochus who tried to persecuted and tried to maybe even exterminate or certainly harm both religiously and physically the Jewish community? I mean, Pesach, we didn't have our fair share of enemies there. Are there not other Jewish holidays? I mean, isn't that so many of them are exactly that, right? Which Jewish holiday is not about us being, right? There's some danger, right? Sukkot is pretty good because it's not, right? There's no physical enemy. It's just the desert, right? So we do pretty well there. But so many of our holidays are about this pattern. And the question is, why did Purim become the model?
Diaspora holiday.
Okay, good. So many of these incidents happen outside of Israel, just like Purim. Excellent. Although Pesach.
Right, but Pesach eventually, I guess. But there are that does people do recall that kind of Pesach Exodus and other things like that does.
You do have that nowadays, right? You have we're fortunate to receive a large shipment or something like that, books to school. So we actually got an Ethiopian Haggadah happened to come with the shipment, right? And so on and so forth, right? Yeah. They have the USSR and so on and so forth. Many, many types.
We fair fought enough back in Purim. So there's a military component to this.
Good.
So when they're still fighting back, I feel like it's the next day. You can when you're able to the battlefield's quiet, yeah, that you can assess
on the exhale. On the exhale,
yeah, and then celebrate what
you can reflect. And
yeah, but the day of itself feels like it would have been.
Good. Yeah, 100%. I think that that's right. And I think we're going to see that as we move forward. Now, the notion of the enemy also is an interesting one. Here we have a large group of enemies. The Purim story is a little bit different, but also in terms of the fighting back. You know, medieval Jewish history, we don't typically think of the Jews fighting back. Right. And that's an interesting distinction as well, but we'll see that momentarily, actually, an interesting counterexample to that, yeah.
I think Purim is the only one that really is a model for the subsequent ones because, first of all, it's not going to be a Yom Tov. It has to be, you know,
it's not biblical. It's
right.
Not from the Torah.
And also, Hanukkah is different in that it was a protracted war. And I don't think any of the other ones involved that.
Good. Excellent. Those
and Hanukkah is more fraught, I think.
Please do explain.
Oh, no.
Can't just say it. You can't just, you know, stop there.
Right? You can't. I mean, I think Purim we were... Purim we were... Oh boy, this is complicated. Yeah, this is much bigger. I won't.
Hanukkah is more fraught.
Hanukkah. Our military victory in Hanukkah is not something in Purim where we were fighting back, and there's this edict. You know, there's a framework for it. I think Hanukkah gets a little bit more complex because of our traditional discomfort with the notion of Jews in the role of military positions and power. We'll leave it at that.
That's great. In other words, Purim was not reflective of. Purim was just sort of a moment in which you step out of character in just pure self-defense, whereas taking on the trappings of warriors was not always comfortable, especially in a Talmudic or medieval retelling.
Because there was no assumption that they would continue as warriors. Like, after this was over, you fought back, there was self-defense, and then life goes back to normal, you know, and then we celebrate.
The notion of being a warrior had become, even though in Tanakh, of course, it's glorified, right? And that kind of tells the story. I have to look now at the 20th and 21st century. So we've come full circle. So, yeah, it is complicated. I thought you meant, or I would add to what you said also, that Hanukkah was also a civil war, we know.
Mm.
And we don't tell it that way necessarily in our schools always, but, you know, as we grow up, etc. But it's complicated, right? It's right. There was an external dimension, but there was also a Jewish dimension that had grew up, that had taken over the temple proper, literally taken over the Kohen Gadolah. There was tremendous internal strife as well. So it wasn't as easy as Jews against their Gentile enemies who simply sought to exterminate them. This was a very complicated working out of internal Jewish tensions as well. You don't really have that. And the same way when it comes to Purim. Purim is almost a simpler holiday. It's kind of neater in a lot of different ways. I think that that's all right. So what I'm going to do is to continue to trace this theme and to look at other instances that I think might enrich our understanding, sort of give us more of a broad perspective on what this pattern looked like. When and how did you celebrate these modern-day Purims, as it were, and what light does that shed on this larger topic? So I first want to go back, and then I want to go forward. So when we travel back in time to the year, now we're in 1038. So we started in 1236, we went back to 1038. I'm going to fast forward to a little bit later in the Middle Ages. And I want to at this point introduce a personality you may be familiar with, may have heard of, Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid. Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid is, we're now in, moved from France to Spain. We're in the Golden Age of Spain. So the Golden Age of Spain is a time in which we have convivencia, we have a very healthy, positive, warm relationships between Jewish poets, thinkers, philosophers, astronomers, scientists of all sorts, and their Muslim neighbors, their Muslim friends. It was a very closely integrated Jewish community. There were a few instances of eruptions of anti-Semitism, for example, in 1066, but on the whole, from around 950 to 1150, basically until around the time that the Rambam is born, this is a time of relative peace, tranquility, and some very beautiful, moving, if complicated at times, relationships between the Jewish and Gentile neighbors. Very different than when we think about Christian medieval Jewish history. It's a very different kind of time under Jewish, under Muslim rule, Jews in Muslim lands. So here we have Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid. Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid rises to become the vizier, become number two to the caliph at that time. And Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid, speaking of warriors, is exactly that. Yes, he's a poet. Yes, he's a scholar. Yes, he's in charge of the finances of the kingdom, essentially. But he also leads not the Jews in battle, but leads, believe it or not, leads Muslims in battle on behalf of the caliphate at that time. He's appointed by a caliph by the name of, or the vizier, he's, or by the name of Khabus. Is the first name, Khabus al-Muzaffar, Khabas al-Muzaffar, right, I think now. This was an individual, this caliph actually had a number of enemies. And one of the enemies was an individual that we're going to have to see when we're talking about. And Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid, according to what we know, actually fended off an uprising on behalf of the vizier and was victorious on the battlefield in what we think is the year 1036. In 1036. He has some fun with this because we mentioned he wasn't just a warrior, he was a world-class poet. And we actually have a Hebrew translation of his poem that he wrote after returning victoriously from the battlefield. So what I want to do is to share a little bit. If you jump, we're going to come back to the opening section of the source sheet. But if you go to, skip a couple pages to the first sort of non-regular source sheet, where it says it's a Hebrew page, and I think it's the seventh side altogether. It says, Echa, on the top it says, Nibra chad mi shirei ha-milchama shel Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid. Okay, so get this. This is one of the outstanding scholars of Jewish history. This is one of the war songs of Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid. And then in the Hebrew, it gives you a little bit of his biography. He lived from 993 to 1055. He was the Rosh HaMemshel, the vizier of Chabas, the king of Granada, which is the area of Spain that we're talking about at that time. And he went to defend the kingdom at that time. So we're going to read parts of the Hebrew, not the entire poem, but just to give a sense as to how he identified the nature of this battle in which he was successful. So if you look at the beginning of the poem, he writes as follows. Eloka oz v'kel kano v'nora. God who is strong. Everyone sees where it is, right under that line in the right column. God who is strong, God who is jealous and almighty. Miromam at aleichol shir v'shira. You are elevated upon any kind of song that we might sing. We're actually missing a couple of lines, so that's the ellipses. V'yesh koret aleina shivirito. There are those who forge a covenant upon my soul. V'yesh gam li brit avot shemura. I have also committed myself. I have continued to observe the covenants of my forefathers. In other words, my success on the battlefield or professionally representing the kingdom, representing the Jewish community, is only because of my ongoing commitment to our traditions, to the covenant that began with Abraham so many years prior. How can I not retell the actions of God? God endowed me with the mouth. I have the capacity for speech. I have a religious obligation to utilize my talents in the praising of the Almighty and praising of God. I think this is just such a profound religious statement about his approach to life, about his philosophy of Judaism. God gave us physical gifts that at first glance might look purely physical, but it's our opportunity and our responsibility to utilize those to praise the Lord and to utilize them for Avodah Hashem in any way that we can. Check this. Be'et ra'ah Agag. Be'it ra'ah Agag. When Agag saw, who is Agag?
The father of Haman. I'm not father, the Agagite.
It's the ancestor of Haman. So he's identified with Haman. Also, in rabbinic tradition, identified with Amalek. So we're coming up to Parashat Zachor this week. So we have an equation in rabbinic writings between Haman and Amalek. Shaul was fighting Amalek, and then we have the continuation of that war that Mordechai and Esther pick up, Jewish community picks up so many years later in the Purim story. So here we have the enemy combatant on the other side of the battlefield is identified as whom? Right? This is Haman or Agag. Right. So it says, "Be'idra Agag shochin lechof yam," because it was from an eastern kingdom that was coast dwelling. Umishnehu b'neu abas mikora. That's the name of the enemy. Kevodi et p'nei malki v'chichol dvar malchut ve'etsa b'gizura. And it goes on and say that so they tried to destroy me. They tried to defeat me. If you jump underneath the next Hebrew section, the four lines that are isolated, v'lo oti levad b'keish lahashmid. Not only I did he seek to destroy. Bikesh l'hashmid, a phrase taken directly from Megillat Esther. Bikesh l'hashmid v'arov v'labed v'kol yudim, etc. So even the language is closely connected to that of the Megillah. V'divato asher bada uvara, with his language that he invented and created. Aval rather, bikesh l'hachrit, he sought to cut down la'adat kel, the entire congregation of the Jewish community. And this is someone who didn't just want to kill the kingdom, but he was anti-Semitic as well. She'ar vanin v'yoledet v'hara, any remnant, any child or grandchild, any mother who had given birth or was expecting, who was pregnant, all these individuals sought to destroy. And he goes on, he tells the entire story and describes the victory on the battlefield. And I want to read just one more section that comes after a theme. If you jump to the left column, if you go under the fourth ellipses and that larger middle section, so I'm going to start the fifth line where it says V'hayu. Mm-hmm. Is that V'hayu? So he continues the story. V'hayu Magag. He's talking about the officers who were engaged with this enemy combatant. V'hayu Magag Malkam Kedomen V'toch HaSadeh. They were like a corpse in the field. V'im lahem kavura. No one to bury them. This is after their miraculous victory, of course. V'echad min revava nisharuvan. There was only one out of 1,000 that remained, which is a line, ironically taken from the Tochecha, Echad, that they're going to pursue us. Right, 1 in 1,000 is going to survive that pursual. So this is an inversion of the tochecha. The very punishment that will ultimately befall the Jewish community is now being turned on her enemies. Ke'oleilot b'cherem yom b'tzira, like the small, almost nebuch, additional grapes, so sort of the undergrown grapes that remain on the day of harvesting. So you have the farmer goes out to the field to harvest the grapes and leaves the one that are undernourished, that are not worth even bothering with. And so those are the ones that remained from the battlefield, from among the enemy combatants who had survived. V'tam zecher Amalek misfarad. V'tam zecher Amalek misfarad. Any memory of Amalek was destroyed from Spain, from Sfarad. Amalek, Spain? What are you talking about? That's a non sequitur. We don't have Amalek in Spain. Says Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid, and every, like we say in the Haggadah, every single generation, they rise against us. It's essentially saying the same thing. Our Amalek had been defeated. V'sar chilamu mamachtam gezurah. Their combatants or their warriors were removed. Their kingdom was cut off. Lefanim mit agag baals. Lefanim mit agag yad Shmuel. Lefanim meaning originally, previously in Jewish history, Agag, the Amalekite king who had been killed by Shmuel himself. So he's going back to the story in Sefer Shmuel. The Haman aidei baal svara. Haman had been killed by the individual who had smarts. Why is it? It's a reference to Mordechai, in that Mordechai sat on the Sanhedrin. To be a member of the Sanhedrin, one required a certain kind of analytical skill set. So presumably, it's a reference to Mordechai. Umikedem Amalek bavira'a. Previously, Amalek had come in negative intention. The ulam, however, in leviato chazara. That ain't happening again. This, he says, this is the final nail in the coffin. This is the defeat of Amalek. I'm not sure history hasn't really borne that out, but that's how he sees this. Yeah,
Zvasha. No, I just thought it was interesting that he said that there is one left, because that was like the whole problem with Shaul, right? Mm. That he left over the people that he thought were helpless.
Right.
Or the women, you know, like whatever that he lost.
Very good. Difference might be that this was that he had been charged and intentionally spared them. Whereas here, they were victorious. Every single thing that they could do in order to defeat the enemy, they did as best they could. But yes, there's definitely an irony there. Now, there's a tradition that builds on this poem and says that Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid similarly celebrated an annual Purim. By the way, this is an aside. This is good for another shiur, for another time. But the whole notion about never inventing new holidays, which is a dispute both in terms of positive holidays, but also in terms of mournful ones, the Yom HaShoah controversy, all these kinds of things. Or Yom HaTzmaut. On the flip side, these are very interesting examples that need to be brought into the equation. In other words, you have at least local communities, if not all of Klal Yisrael, celebrating these as local holidays for not just on a one-time basis, but in near perpetuity. Wow. That's essentially how they're established in many of these cases. Now, it might be different because it's not a national day of mourning or a national day of celebration. It's a local one, but it's still, I think, an important part of the discussion. And I don't know if it's been mentioned, because it's just not familiar, I think, in many of the halachic discussions. I think many of those who are writing aren't necessarily studying the ins and outs of Jewish history, so I think it might not be part of the discussion.
What do they
think
do? Do we know? Like, do they have rituals that they, besides just kind of declaring the day?
Great question. Every community was different. We don't have great information. Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid, we know that he celebrated with his family. That's really all we have. In other cases, we'll see they wrote scrolls that were publicly read on the day annually, which I think that's already a formalized ritual. Certainly meals, things like that. But that, I think, is the clearest ritual that we have. So we'll be seeing that as well. So that's when we go back to Spain in the year 1038. Now we want to fast forward to 1420, also in Spain, in a town known as Saragossa, that community, if anyone's familiar with that. So here we have another story. And this is the first known example, although I was not able to get my hands on it for this year. I'm still working on it. I couldn't find it online. I found a number of interesting texts online. This one I wasn't able to find yet, so I'll try to make the trip to Penn and spread it around. But this is a community where you have a little bit of a different story. It's a story of an apostate Jew, which unfortunately is a story that we know now. We're already in Christian Spain. An apostate Jew who converts over to Catholicism or comes over to the Christian side. And what happens? What does he want to prove, this individual? Right, he's not just now a Christian. What does he try to do? Right, what do people suspect him of, potentially?
Being a crypto Jew.
Yeah, he might be, right? The crypto Jews were just beginning around that time in 1420. It was more later on, 1492, but just beginning that phenomenon. Is he really dedicated? Is he really committed? Is he truly authentic? Right? Is this really someone who's fully bought into the Christian faith? Or is this just like an external act of baptism just to avoid persecution and to make a buck or to, you know, to do well with Christian neighbors or something like that? So very often the Jews who had converted to Christianity, they went out of their way to try to prove their bona fides to the church. Mm-hmm. And the best way, or one of the best ways to prove your bona fides to the church in a year like 1420 was... to come up with some pretext about something that the Jews did wrong. Right? So somehow attack them, maybe not physically, but often to issue some sort of accusation, something along those lines. That's exactly what happens in this year. Again, the details a little bit sparse, but we do know that there was such an incident, that there was a scroll that was written by that local community, which is highly similar to Megillat Esther. We'll see another example of this in a few moments. And according to tradition, at least, this scroll, and this is hard to say this is historical for sure, but this scroll, according to at least legends, was the first that included the term that we all know, Yimach Shemo. Where does that come from? Yimach Shemo. So we're familiar with it. We use it in context of the Holocaust, the most commonly in our community nowadays, but it wasn't invented at that time. The history of the term Yimach Shemo is not so clearly known, but at least according to legend, this scroll might have been one of the earliest texts to invoke that terminology in reference to the local Haman of that story.
But you also had the expression Timche et Zekr al Malek from Chumash.
Well, that's where it comes from, and so it works out quite nicely, I think.
Right.
That's a nice fit. That's well said. Yes, absolutely. What I mean to say is just a popularized term that we use.
Yeah, a lot of times.
Exactly. Exactly, but 100%. It has biblical roots. So I don't have the actual original scroll. I have another one that's going to be upcoming. This is what I gave you next is taken from a book of folklore. So I want to be clear and say this is not a historical text in the traditional sense. You know, sometimes you go online, you Google any of these things, you find all sorts of things. And a critical historian will say, well, that's nice, but there's absolutely no resemblance to what I do when I study history. So I want to be careful and say that I'm trying to distinguish between texts that are authentic, stories that we know about, what we do know, what we don't know. But very often, even the legends that we tell as a people tell us a lot about who we are and what our mindset is. So this is a very late account of something from 1420. This is from is published in 1907, although it comes from a little bit earlier, but I think it gives you a sense as to how this story has at least been told throughout the generations. Here's how it goes. It says, a few of the Jews should be Jewish residents at Jerusalem celebrate, everyone has it on the next page, celebrate beside the usual feasts of Passover, Pentecost, Shavuot, Tabernacles, Sukkot, etc., a yearly anniversary which they call the Saragossan Purim. They call it, we have the Purim of Nerbon, the Saragossan Purim, in order to commemorate the deliverance of the Jews of Saragossa, the capital of the former kingdom of Aragon, from a great peril. The story of this escape is recorded in certain small parchment scrolls, or Megillot, written in the style and evident imitation of the Roll of Esther. I don't know if that was supposed to be Scrollvester, is read in public at each celebration. I had heard of the custom a good many years ago, writes the author, but on February 13, 1906, having been informed that the festival had been held 2 days before, I obtained the loan through a friend of a copy of the roll. It was, of course, in Hebrew, not in parchment. So in other words, according to at least this legend, they wrote the story, not just on some sort of formal parchment. The narrative is briefly as follows. About the year 1420, in the reign of Alfonso V of Aragon, there were in the city of Saragossa 12 handsome synagogues. This is a very well-off and prosperous community, supported by as many congregations of prosperous and influential Jews. We're so well-treated by the government that whenever the king came to Saragossa, all the rabbis went out in procession to honor him, each carrying in its case the roll of the law belonging to a synagogue. People objected that it was dishonor for the sacred rules to be carried out to flatter the vanity of a Gentile. And so the rabbis, possibly glad of an excuse not to carry the heavy manuscripts, got in the habit of leaving the scrolls at the synagogues on such occasions and going out with the empty cases. Okay, so you know what's going to come next. Now, a certain Jew named Marcus of Damascus turned Christian, and in his zeal as a new convert became the deadly enemy of his own race. When the king one day was praising the loyalty of his Jewish subjects, this renegade, who was among the courtiers, replied that his majesty was being grossly deceived. The loyalty of the Jews was a sham, he averred, like the carrying empty cases before the king when pretending to bear the roles of their respective synagogues. At this, the king was angered against the Jews, but would not punish them until he had ascertained the truth of the charges. Of the charge, he set out at once on the 17th of Shvat for Saragossa with Marcus in his train, and the latter was in high spirits, thinking that he had ruined the Jews. So this is their shades here of Haman. Not exactly, but you can see the parallels. But that night, right? Balayla hahu nadidashnat hamelech. That night, the king couldn't sleep. That night, there was a moment of salvation. That night, an aged man roused the servant of each synagogue and told him how the king intended to surprise the rabbis. So when the noise of the king's coming went abroad next morning and they went out to meet him as usual, they were not unprepared. Alfonso did not return the greetings, but frowning, ordered the cases to be opened. His command was obeyed very cheerfully, and every case was found to contain its scroll of the Pentateuch. The king then turned his anger upon Marcus, who was hanged from the nearest tree. To commemorate this event, the Jews of Saragossa instituted an annual feast, observed even after subsequent persecutions had driven them from Spain, and still, as we have seen, celebrated by their descendants on the 17th of Shabbat. Purim of Saragossa. So you start to see a new development here. It's written on a scroll. You have the explicit parallels that are kept from generation to generation. And so while it's hard to say for sure, because some of it, again, there's the legend piece, and it's hard to know, kind of tease out what's memory and what's actual history. But we maybe have the development, at least in popular imagination, of the notion it was not just that there was some Haman-like personality who tried to kill the Jews, and maybe there was some poetic record and celebration, but now we have some sort of ritualization. We have it set to writing. We have the retelling of a story celebrated by that community for generation with the reading of the scrolls, perhaps for hundreds of years, according to at least this account. So the notion of the concretization of this day into a real quasi-Purim, I think, is something that begins to develop around this time. And what I want to share is that what's fascinating, and this text I did find, was one from Cairo, so now moving to another country. What's interesting also is the variety of Jewish diaspora communities that we find the phenomenon of the modern-day Purim. So now we're in 1524, Cairo, so we're in the Egyptian Jewish community, and here we have again, political intrigue between different sides in the Muslim leadership at that time. The Sultan at that time is Suleiman the Great, an outstanding Sultan. In 1524, as an aside, it's interesting, assuming all the dating is correct, the chief rabbi of Cairo at that time was none other than the Radvaz, Rabbi David ben Zimra, who was a major rabbinic personality, as a classical commentary on the Rambam, a serious player in Jewish scholarship. At that time, we have Suleiman is opposed by this up-and-comer who basically foments a rebellion. His name is Ahmed Shaitan. It's true, I'm not making it up. Okay, this is exactly what we have. He's the viceroy. He's actually appointed, according to the story, the viceroy of Cairo. He is. It's already under Ottoman rule. Ottoman rules from roughly 1517 to 1917. Those 400 years. Cairo, Israel, of course, etc. According to the story, there are a number of prominent Jews who were seized by, by Ahmed Shaitan as part of his rebellion. He threatens the Jews, he confiscates property, and there is a battle that develops eventually between his backers and those of the Sultan, and there's sort of this battle royale that breaks out, and ultimately another individual, the vizier at that time, by the name of Muhammad Bey, is actually able to kill this Ahmed Shaitan, who tried to kill the Jewish community members of the Jewish community of Cairo at that time. That's how the story, at least, is generally told. Now, check this. After the salvation of this community, we have... that throw you off. Didn't expect to hear that. Okay, you should hear me talk to the teenagers. Okay, so we have a scroll that has survived, that is known in scholarly circles as Megillat Mitzrayim, as the Egyptian scroll. This has been published by serious academic historians. It's available. I found an article, a scholarly article online, which has about a 4-page introduction to the history. It was found in a museum. It was analyzed closely by scholars. There's I think our version, our outstanding version, is in Hebrew, and then I have here at least part of an English translation. If anyone's interested in getting the rest of the English translation, I have it for you. So we're not going to read the whole thing, but this is what that community believes to be an authentic reconstruction of the events. Now, if you take a look, it says 277 on the top, Megillat Mitzrayim, and it gives you the text. This is taken from that article. Section 1 was a historical overview of the text, and it's what we know about it. And then you have the actual Hebrew. It says Megillat Mitzrayim. So this might look familiar as well at times. And this was something that we believe the community read for many, many years. Vayihi bimei hamelech Shlomo. Okay?
Suleiman,
right? This is great. So we replace Ahasuerus with Suleiman, but we don't want to call him Suleiman because this is a traditional Jewish text. And also we like him. He's the good guy. So we call him Shlomo, right? And then it's code, right? So there's a lot of self-censorship in Jewish history. So we write Shlomo. And this one, anyone who wants to give trouble to the Jews also, it's not just sacred text, right? We say, oh no, this is just a traditional Jewish text about King Solomon. And as we'll see, his someone else from taken from Jewish traditional sources. So, it occurred in the names of the king Shlomo, who Amel Shlomo, Hamolech b'malchut togarma, right? This is exactly the first pasuk of Megillat Esther. Unbelievable, and it continues throughout. Malchut, except it's not, right? It's not Malchut HaChashverosh, etc., Hodu Ad Kush, and all that. It's Malchut Togarma. It's the Turkish Empire. Right? The Turkish, that's how we refer to Turkey in traditional Jewish texts. The Eretz HaMizrach and the Eastern countries, right? The East. The Eretz Yavan and the area of Greece. Uvimachanot Rabot. And in many, many different locations, many camps, as it were. The King Solomon sat on his royal seat. Asher?
Because.
What's that?
Constantine.
Okay, Constantinople. Okay. Ha'ir HaGdolah. Gotta love it. V'yitbonin b'chol medinot malchuto. He examined all of the different kingdoms under his reign. V'yishlach l'chol medina u'medinan. He sent forth to every single country. Sar echad, a single officer. L'shpot et hama b'tzedek u'mishpat. To judge his nation appropriately, and so on and so forth. So all these events are taking place, and he forges a covenant, and he's this wondrous king, and everyone loves him and reveres him for his fairness and for his integrity, his honesty, and his care for the entire kingdom. And then he takes an individual, Charad Varim Ha'ela, fourth line, the end, Gidal HaMelech Shlomo. So now we've kind of fast-forwarded the story to the third chapter, to start the second chapter. So Charad Varim Ha'ela, Gidal HaMelech Shlomo. The king, Shlomo, so Suleiman, he appoints Ishechad Misarav, right? So he makes him his Haman. Ushmo, except his name is not Haman, rather his name is Hasatan Hayadua. Wink, wink. Okay, so who is this? Now get this. Remember, what was his name? That's what I mentioned earlier. Ahmed Shaitan. Okay, Ahmed Shaitan. This is convenient. The Jews are loving this one, okay? I.e., better known as the Satan, okay? Shaitan. They called him the Satan. Ushmo HaSatan HaYazua. Vayasem et kiso mi'alko asarim asher ito. So he appointed him right to his position. And he makes him the king of Egypt, and he throws in some Yosef language as well. Vayasem et kiso, he says. Excuse me, no, he's the other line, sorry. Where'd it go? I'll give the entirety of Egypt to you, Vatyashev, and you shall sit in it, V'alpicha, that's language. Yishak kol ami, this is taken from Yosef. Yosef is appointed the viceroy, second in command. Same thing, it's happening in Egypt. Rakak yisei egdal mimeka, except, right? It's exactly the same, intentionally so.
Partial miketz.
Exactly, right? Except, of course, intentionally inverted again. Vayavoha satan hayadua, el eretz Mitzrayim, so he comes and he occupies his position. And the king had told him to be honest and fair in his dealings, as I said. Of course, he does just the opposite. I mean, this is a complete caricature. It might be completely true, but it's a complete caricature, as he's dishonest, and he makes side deals with all sorts of different wealthy people in the kingdom, and he's got tons of money coming in. And then, not only that, but he arises to a position of such stature, he's bribed enough influential people, that he begins to mount opposition to the sultan at that time. And so, he gathers people behind him, and before you know it, there's an all-out rebellion against the sultan at that time. And they start to fight, and things go from bad to worse. We're going to jump a while. If you're interested, I gave you, again, part of the English, and I think I gave you the entire Hebrew text as well. Ultimately, as part of this rebellion, now, it was not first and foremost against the Jews, right? It was kind of like the Crusades. We just kind of got quite swept up in the other winds of the time. But, hey, there's an opportunity to hurt some Jews along the way. Why not? So that kind of thing. So as part of this whole series of events, he figures, you know what? Why don't we turn against the Jews as well? So I'm now on page 278, about 12 lines down. First word on the line is kol. First word is kol. I'm right after the period in that line. Third word on that line. Vayavo'u chel ha-satan hayadua. So the warriors of this Achmed Shaitan approach him. Vayamru elav. Say to him, Adonenu ha-melech. So they've already anointed him king. Ataya data ma'ar the sultan. Ataya data, you know, ma'asu avadecha lecha v'machnucha alenu melech b'Mitzrayim. We've appointed you Egyptian king. Ve'ata imatsu avadecha chen be'inecha. V'im al ha-melech tov, kinotein dat, you know the rest already, la-shmid, la-harog, la-abed et kol ha-yehudim, v'nar v'yadzakein, tafen ha-shem, v'shalalam l'voz, u'lunakim ahem, kihim o'yevinu, v'tzareinu, we're going to take vengeance from them. Why not kill the Jews along with, just to make it a little bit more interesting. And, right, so, but now here, it was interesting, so he's the Satan, but now he's no longer playing the role of Haman. He's actually now playing the role of... I would say Achashverosh, because he's now the king. He's been elevated to king, right? He's been elevated to the position of king, and they are they're approaching him with money and incentives to destroy the Jews. And he said, "This is great."
But they're using the Jews, Esther's language.
They're using Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, so it's almost like a pericope of different sections in the Megillah that are brought together here. Also, Megillah language. There's a great mourning. That's the same thing. It's literally, you feel the emotions in the story. So they don the dirt. They mourn. Now we have the language from Yirmiyahu, if I remember correctly, but Teval Haaretz, the Umal Kol Yoshveba, and everyone is mourning. Next line, Haratzim Yatzu Dechufim Bidvar HaSatan HaYadua. I mean, it just goes on and on with exactly the same language. And now, although it's kind of told a little bit perhaps out of order, they daven, God hears their prayers, like in Mitzrayim, it ascends to the heavens. And then, fourth line from the bottom of this page, Ish. Except it doesn't say Ish Yehudi, it says Ish
Yechidi.
You get the idea. And it's in big language, right? And presumably they repeated the Pasuk just like we do nowadays when they read it publicly. Right. And this individual told it basically to make the long story short, or a little bit shorter, it's a pretty long story, is he approaches the king and he buys him back for the Jewish community, and ultimately they're saved and he reverses course, and ultimately the Jews go to their own defense. Samson, they actually rally, they don't actually fight in this story. They rally the troops of the Sultan to chase away the troops of the rebellion, and ultimately they are defeated. They lose close, it's not perfect, but they actually are, the attempted destruction, it says, is on the 9th, it's actually confusing, it's the 19th of Adar. Just not bad. It's pretty close. Right, that's when the story takes place, and it goes on and on and on, but that pretty much gives you the story. The community, according to this tradition, read this story in every generation like they were reading Megillah Esther, probably just a few days later. It's the same story, just retold through a contemporary lens. And so you have this tradition, this ritualizing of these events where it becomes the new story of Esther. There are many other stories we're not going to spend as much time. I'll mention a few very quickly. If you go to Khmelnytsky massacres, 1648, terrible massacres in Ukraine, there's a Purim story there in the community of Mezhibich, which is a famed Hasidic town later on in Jewish history as well. But in that community at that time, there were hordes of Ukrainian peasants who were running through, and that community was miraculously spared. They celebrate their own Purim. If you jump to it, that was in Teves, though. The 11th day of Teves, as it happened, which, interestingly enough, is right, the day after
10th of Teves.
That's also very similar, right? You have Tanit Esther, and then you have Asara B'Tevet, and then you have the celebration the next day. Very interesting, right? If you jump to, get this, the Greek island of Rhodes. The Greek island of Rhodes. I'm just going quickly. Make sure we get to the end. The Greek island of Rhodes in the year 1840, which is the same year as the Damascus blood libel. Mm-hmm. The Damascus blood libel, right, is, I mean, this is it. They're saved. The Damascus blood libel is a major event. It's one of the early troubling signs for the fate of European Jewry, basically. Those who are familiar with this story. We don't have to go through all the details, but that starts a trend, and they spread like wildfire, these blood libel accusations. Moses Montefiore gets involved. There's a whole story there, but there is the Jewish community on the Greek island of Rhodes has their own blood libel and their own story of salvation, and so they also have their own Purim, which begins, and it seems that they were victorious on none other than the 14th day of Adar. So they wrapped it up with their Purim. So they just said, just celebrate it all together. So that's what they did. You have this also for individuals. I'll give just two examples. You have this for, some might have heard of the Tosfot Yom Tov, of Yom Tov Lipman Heller. This is a fantastic biography, which was actually written by a member of our community, it's a fantastic, an outstanding biography, first rate. And he was appointed chief rabbi of Bohemia in 1627. It was right around the time of the 30 Years' War. So we were caught in this massive war that ultimately spread across most of Europe. And the Jews were required to collect taxes. As chief rabbi, his responsibility was to collect taxes from the town. The Jews felt that he was being unfair in the allocations. So a number of wealthy Jews started spreading stories about him. And ultimately is tossed in prison in 1629. Suffers indignities for some 15 years. Until ultimately on the first day of Elul, 14 years later in 1644, finally, ultimately becomes the last of his troubles. He ultimately gets the chief rabbi position of Krakow, and he moves with his family, and it begins a really very positive part of their life story. And he... Krakow, sorry.
Abigail.
What?
Abigail is now the chief rabbi of
Krakow.
You know?
Oh, I hadn't heard that. Okay, got it. Interesting. That's right. Draw the connection. It's okay. And this is the first of Adar, I apologize, in 1644, and that becomes, his family celebrates that every year. And you have other stories like this. There's another rabbi, the author of the Chaye Adam, Rav Avram Danzig, has a similar story a little bit later on in 1804. There's not so much an enemy, but there's a powder keg in his building that kills a number of members of the housing unit in which his family lived, and they miraculously survived, and they celebrate their own Purim. So you see this formalizing, you see this spreading, you see this applying to communities across the Jewish diaspora, outstanding individuals as well celebrating. And I want, with all this background, I want to come back to sort of our opening question and come back to that issue. And in addition, in light of what we've seen, in light of all these stories and formalization of the ritual, and especially celebrating the next day, which we've seen on a number of occasions, and the choice of Purim of all holidays, in addition to some of the elements that we've seen, what exactly might be the reason that we've chosen Purim as the sort of the prototype for all these celebrations? I wanted to add just one point to what's been mentioned, but I think everything that was said earlier I think is right. And I want to base this on a sort of a distinction that I gave you. We're not going to read all the sources here, but I gave them to you if you're interested in the first couple of pages. And I want to note, sort of in closing, a distinction that we find between Hanukkah on the one hand and Purim on the other. When we tell the Hanukkah story, so again, it's more fraught and it's more complicated, but it does have external enemies and they are coming to attack us. How does the holiday become instituted? Who does it? And what's interesting is that if you take a look at the story in the Gemara, a later year, the Gemara tells us, the Gemara says, L'shana acheret, Gemara in Shabbat, I give it to you here, but the Gemara basically says that L'shana acheret, on another occasion, the rabbis came along and instituted this holiday, and then the community followed. They celebrated it on the same day of the victory, or began celebrating the same day of the victory. They rededicated the temple on Chaf Hei Kislev, and we began the holiday of Hanukkah on that same day. And the rabbis, in a later year, came along and celebrated it. The Rambam has a similar retelling of the story. If you take a look onto page 2, he says something very similar. He says actually in that same generation, but he stresses that the rabbis instituted it. It was a top-down holiday. In Halacha Gimel, the Rambam writes the beginning of his treatment of Hilchot Chanukah, Omipnei ze hitzkinu chachamim shebeoto hador, right? The chachamim, the scholars, the rabbis of that generation, instituted this holiday. Purim, on the other hand, was quite different. How was Purim instituted? What do we read in the Gilad Esther? We'll read it in just a short number of days. What do we say? Did the rabbis come along and institute it? What does it say? What does it say in the ninth chapter, in the penultimate parak?
Mordechai and Esther.
Okay, right. Mordechai and Esther working together with the community, and it basically says that although they called for the community to accept it, but the emphasis is on the community's own celebration, their own acceptance of the holiday. It was almost spontaneous. There's this dynamic that plays out where the community itself, the Jewish community, is itself the source of the authority. Now, it needs the agreement of the rabbinic leadership. It needs a halachic impretur to be recognized as a permanent Jewish holiday, of course. But the initiative, as opposed to Hanukkah, which was top-down, is actually bottom-up. That's the story. That's why the spontaneity is the reason that it was celebrated on the next day. Because what we do is to relive the events the exact way that happened, just like they did. They just celebrated the next day. They couldn't keep it on that day. They were exhausted. Imagine what that must have felt like. They were a little bit tired after having fought for their lives. If you could, they could wait an extra day to celebrate the holiday, whether on the 14th or 15th, depending on which community they found themselves. And so that's really the nature of Purim. It's a spontaneous celebration of that local community in appreciation of the miracles that had taken place. Mm-hmm. And the Gemara bears this out, because the Gemara tells exactly the story on page 5. And of Zayin and Aleph, the Gemara has two versions of this. One is that Esther sent a letter to the rabbi saying, establish me for all generations. And the other version is that Esther sent a letter asking the rabbis to write it down, to canonize the book of Esther. To canonize, to accept it as the book. Kiva'uni lidarot, kitvuni lidarot. And there's some back and forth, there's some discussion. And they say, you know what? It's okay, we're going to do this. It's going to work out. And so they accept the holiday. This confirms the Gemara is telling the story. It starts with the impetus of the community with its leadership, but it's the leadership that we're ensconced within the community. It's Esther as a representative of her people. That's clear from the ninth chapter of the Megillah. And so I think what's happening is that an additional reason, part of what's happening in all of these stories throughout Jewish history, is that the Jewish community has a certain spontaneity. It's not just, oh, there's the rabbis came along and established a holiday. That's a legitimate model as well. But these are about communities that understood what persecution was like. They understood what it meant for their lives to be on the line, and they lived with that anxiety before these events took place, during these events, and afterward as well. And once they were able to exhale and breathe, whether it was after Shmuel HaNagid went out to the battlefield and fought, or it was the Jewish community of Narbonne was spared from their incidents, or maybe they wrote a Megillah, like in Saragossa in 1420, or in Cairo during the years of their celebration in 1524, whatever it may have been, it came from the community because there was that existential angst, but then that sigh of relief and that sense of appreciation, sense that we need to do something as a community. And I think this really speaks to what Purim is all about, because I think Purim is really a holiday in which we take initiative. We took initiative and we take initiative. And we say that despite all those who come along and attempt to exterminate us until this very day, there's sort of a psychological element to this that's very healthy and deeply empowering. They didn't necessarily have tzahal. Shmuel HaNagid was more fortunate than the other communities in all of these stories. But there was something they could do. They could take ownership over their story. They could celebrate it on their own, in their own way, to establish a ritual that was deeply rooted in Jewish tradition, that was consistent with the Haman story, that was consistent with the Esther story, that sometimes was essentially that same story. And I think it's a very powerful statement, not only about these local communities and their narratives, but I think ultimately about what Purim is all about. So my blessing for all of us and all of our Jewish communities at this time is that despite all the challenges that continue to confront us as a people and as a wider Jewish community, that we will feel a sense of empowerment, of initiative, to take ownership and to see the miracles in our own lives, to see the miracles in our people's lives, and to hopefully in that sense truly follow the traditions and the pathways that so many of our prior communities have set forth for us as models. I wish everyone a Freilich and Purim. It is always a pleasure to learn together, and look forward to our next opportunity to come together and learn. Thank you very much.